Good morning. Last week we began the discussion of the Heteriska. Before we get to Heteriska, we went through briefly the halachas of a real iska, a real business deal. As we explained, that if a person invests money where one person is providing the capital, the other person is doing the work, the default, in the absence of any other discussion or any other negotiations, that halacha is, it is 50-50. It is a chatzim over chatzim b'kadoin. Half is a loan, half is an investment. And consequently, they share the profits 50-50 and the loss is 50-50 as well. As we saw, whenever there is such a deal where the manager is receiving half the profits and half the losses, there we do still have a ribbis problem, and that is, he is, in exchange for the chatzimov, in exchange for the loan that he's getting, he is managing the investment without compensation. And therefore the halacha is, you have to pay him something for his work. If you make up in advance, it does not have to be a large sum, a token amount is enough, a dinner is fine, but something needs to be paid. Now, this is a real iska. The investor has exposure. If there's a loss, he suffers half the loss. If there are profits, he receives half the profits. His upside is not capped either. A heter iska is obviously that the goal is to make it act more like a loan. When a person does a heter iska, the lender does not want to be at risk. He does not want to become a partner. He does not want that downside. So the way we accomplish this is that every heter iska starts with a regular iska. The money that's being advanced, it is not a loan, it's being advanced as a true partnership. Because it's a partnership, because it's an iska, the lender, if you will call him the lender, but it's not really a good term, the lender, the investor, is responsible for half of the losses. But to protect him, we add the following clause. Whenever you have a partnership with someone, if he's managing the partnership, and he comes to you at the end of the year and says, I'm very sorry, but the money's all gone. You don't have to trust him. You can say, listen, all I know is I gave you $100,000. It's very nice you tell me it's all gone, but I want proof. I want you to verify what happened to this money and to verify that you weren't negligent. This is a bona fide real business loss. And you have the right to do that. Normally, if there is such a claim between partners, so the partner would make a shvua, whether shvuas hasis, shvuas hashutvim, depending on the case. But all he would have to do is make a shvua, and then the lender, the investor, would share in that loss. However, there's nothing wrong with negotiating a better deal for yourself. The investor can say, "I'm willing to give you this money, but I don't really trust you. And I don't really want to take your word for it or your shvua." So we're making up that if you want to claim there's a loss, you have to bring two kosher witnesses that can testify what happened to this money. Now, if you do that, if you can bring witnesses, you can show there's a loss, the investor, the person who gave the iska, is going to share in that loss. But bringing two kosher witnesses that were involved, that are not negei b'davar, they're not kroivim, is something which is extremely difficult. Now the Trumas Hadeshen adds another level of protection. Trumas Hadeshen says you can restrict who the witnesses are. He says the investor, the lender can say, I don't want to trust you. I don't even want to take the risk to just pull two witnesses off the street. I'm only going to accept that you had a loss if you can bring the Rav and the Chazan to be meyed that there really was a loss. Now, although the Trumas Hadeshen is makel, the Taz says that was only true in those days. It seems the Rav and the Chazan were involved in people's businesses, and they knew what was going on. But today, where the Rav is the last person in town that can testify what happened to anyone's business, so, and Adrabah, whatever you're telling the Rav, you're telling him how hard it is and how you can't give money to the shul. So, his testimony is the least reliable in this case. So there the Taz says, today we do not do this. It has to be something which is possible to be done. Now, in truth, this really leads to another problem, and that is, today it's virtually impossible to have two witnesses that can testify firsthand you did not make any money. You know, even you know, back then the business deals were fairly simple. You bought some fruits and you sold them. So as long as you have witnesses that saw the purchase, they knew how much you paid. They saw what happened when you sold it, how much the sale price was for. So they can testify whether there was a profit, there was a, what the loss was, and it was something which was doable. Today we're, you know, even in a fairly straightforward a real estate deal, you buy a property. How are you going to have two witnesses that can testify this person that this tenant did not pay his rent? He was with you the whole day, 24/7. He can look at the bank account, but who says the person didn't give you cash? It's something which is virtually impossible, which really creates a problem. It is not very clear exactly what the witnesses have to testify, what's called edus and what isn't called edus. What I do in many of the, in the heterodoxes is I write something to the effect, even after you write the fact that you need edim, you write that the Bezdin can use their discretion or based on what halacha, accept whatever testimony or whatever evidence they need to accept al pi halacha. But it's difficult to know exactly where to draw the line, what is called edus, you know, and what isn't. Now this is as far as to protect the principle. To protect the principle, you can say that that you're not going to believe, have nemunas, there's a loss unless you bring edim. If it's a question of collecting the interest or the profits, there the halacha is a bit different. And there the Taz and Lvoz writes that you cannot demand witnesses. You can't tell the person, I'm assuming you made 10% unless you have witnesses that say that you didn't. It's one thing, principle, which yesterday was there, you want to claim it disappeared. There I can say, you want to say it disappeared, the burden of proof is on you. But to require witnesses that you didn't earn profit, that's too much. There the halacha is you have to accept a shavua. What you can tell the person is that if you want to claim there were no profits and therefore you're just going to give me back my principle, nothing else, I don't believe you're not Naaman. But if you make a shavua there were no profits, or if you make a shvua there are minimal profits, then the investor, the lender, only will receive half of whatever profits there were. So what comes out is we have a bit of a problem. What's happening now is that when you're giving money as an iska, it's not a loan; it's a partnership. Because it's a partnership, the investor shares the profits and shares the losses. But it's very difficult to figure out what those profits or losses were. Because the recipient, the only way he's believed is he needs to bring in witnesses that can testify there was a loss. And if he wants to claim there are no profits, he has to make a shavua. What happens if he can't? He doesn't have witnesses. He does not want to make a shavua. So here we give him another option. We tell him, although this is a partnership, and although the investor has exposure to half the losses and is not entitled to any return unless there are profits, if you want to, if instead of bringing edim, instead of making a shvuah about what happened, you can give me back the keren plus whatever the we'll call the interest rate is, plus my 8%, my 10%, whatever the deal is. If you do that, you're buying out your obligation to make a shvuah. You're buying out your obligation to bring edim. You're buying out any other profits that were generated, and everyone goes home happy. So basically, you have a case where although it's a shutvis, although it's a partnership, and the investor has exposure to risk, but that risk can only be realized if the borrower, if the recipient, proves there's a loss or makes a shvur there was no profit. If he does that, there will be a loss. The investor will lose. But if he can't do that, his other alternative is going to be to pay back the principal, the interest, whatever was agreed upon beforehand, and 99 out of 100 cases, this is what happens. Now, there are those that are mefakfik on the concept of heter iska. There are those that say you cannot require edim on a loss, and they basically say it's somewhere between difficult and impossible to bring edim, and therefore they say, instead of that, you should accept a shvua even on a loss. If as long as the recipient swears that he lost the money, you should accept that, and you should split the loss. Reif Paiskim are saimach on it, and they do accept and they allow the lender to say, I'm not going to believe a shvua, I want edus. There's an interesting shvua from the Igros Moshe The Ris Moshe, it seems, Maker Hadin says, there's nothing wrong with writing a heter iska and requiring the borrower to bring, to if he wants to claim there's a loss, to bring two witnesses. But the Ris Moshe has a problem. He says, two witnesses to testify there's a loss? What's the big deal? Today there are many dishonest people out there. And you can just find any two people who come to Beis Din and testify that they know firsthand there was a loss. Therefore, the Gemara says it's not a good idea. You're gonna end up losing your money. Instead, you should make the borrower make a shvua that he didn't lose the money. So, you know, interestingly enough, the fact that people will come and say Eidus Sheker and Beis Din, that the Gemara says that you'll find a dime a dozen that we have to be afraid of. That's not a good idea. But for someone, even if he's willing to be made a shekel bez, but for someone to come and make a shvua chamur that he lost the money, that Digger's Moshe assumes that a person would never do, and therefore, as an eta toiva, that's what he suggests to write in the heter iska. Most heter iskas today are not like that. Most heter iskas do require the edus on the Karen. I think most people consider it more secure and just a better risk. Now, the one loose end we have with this heter iska is that, well, as we mentioned before, even by a true iska, even by a real investment, if you're splitting the profits and losses 50-50, the recipient, the manager, has to get paid for his work. It can be a davar mu'ur, as long as you negotiate in advance, it can be a token payment, but something has to be paid to him for his work. And for this reason, if you look at a heter iska, everyone knows there's a dollar. There's a lot of confusion what the dollar is, who gets the dollar, who pays the dollar, what it's for. The reason why you give a dollar is for schar tircha. The person borrowing the money is not borrowing it. He's managing the investment for both parties. He has to get paid something to manage this investment. And so the iska says that a dinar, a davar mu'ut, and it's usually a dollar is usually the amount used, that is his payment for managing the iska. Now, it has to be paid, but there's no halacha about when it has to be paid. People very often call, they're worried, they wrote a heter iska, but they forgot to give the dollar. The dollar is nothing more than you're paying him, it's his wages for managing the iska. You can pay it whenever you want, it can be paid afterwards, you can have a shliach pay it, someone else can pay it. You just have to make sure at the end of the day, somehow or another, he gets paid something for his management fee. How it's done or when it's done is not especially important. No, so that itself is not, because the revach is coming, it's a chatzim over chatzim bikadin. The profit that he's getting from his chelek ha-milva, once he's the mal loiva and he's responsible for the losses, the male of the profits belong to him. That's not called something that he's receiving from somebody else. Adrab, it's the fact that you gave him an interest-free loan. If you demand that he works in exchange for the interest-free loan, that's ribbis. Every ribbis, the borrower has an upside. He now has the money to invest. So like this. The way it works is like this. The structure is, it's a chatzim of a chatzim because they split the profits and losses 50-50. What they do is the recipient, the borrower, has an option. If he pays the principal plus the 10% plus the interest rate, he is buying out the investor's share of the profits. And even if it earned a 300% return, it doesn't matter. They negotiated in advance that if he pays 10%, then he receives the rest. It's the equivalent of making an investment where your upside is capped. Your downside. So Moisir Shlish, there is a discussion whether Moisir Shlish, the problem with that is that since there's no guarantee in any way that you'll hit that, and where do you draw the line? What happens to anything above a 9,000% return will be yours. So again, there's a discussion of Moisir Shlish, but we're mocked with that it has to be at least a davar mu'ut. Excellent. So we learned before that's ribbis. It may even be ribbis d'orais in that case. So the place can ask, why over here are we mekel with a davar mu'ut? So what they say is that in this case, the recipient, it's a chatzim over chatzim pikadim. He has to do the job for his share anyway. When you have, especially when there are two partners, he's doing the work anyway. He just has to do yours also. There, there's a svar of gvilutur. He's not doing anything extra for you, and therefore a davar mu'ud is enough. Others say that the chatzim bo v'chatzim pikadon is not a real chatzim bo v'chatzim pikadon. That's a discussion b'negia shmitah, b'negia b'char. Chazal looked at it as an investment, as if it was a chatzim ova. Because it may not be a real loan, it's just a ke'ilu dika loan, a derabanon, therefore they were makel on the schar tercha. Those are the two svaras that are mentioned why over here. But you're 100% right. If you lend someone money on the condition that he does a $10,000 job for $5,000, that condition itself would be awesome. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Really, it should be 50% of the profits, whatever that may be. We're agreeing in advance that, in one hand, the investor is capping his upside. Anything above the 8%, whatever we negotiate, you're going to keep. And on the other hand, he's giving the recipient the right, the option, to get out of the shvu and the edim by making this payment. The point over here is that when a person goes into a deal, although normally, especially if you're a muchzik, you have a certain nemanus. If you make a shvur, you certainly have nemanus. I can go into a deal and say, listen, I'm willing to invest $100,000 with you, but I don't really trust you. And therefore, if you want to make any claim that something happened to this money, you're going to have two witnesses that will accompany you, that will be able to come to Bezdin afterwards and back up any claim that you make. And I can do that to protect myself. And if I do that and you choose not to have witnesses, you choose to operate alone, and at the end of the day you make a claim that's not verified or backed up by those witnesses, I can say, I simply don't trust you. Now, if you can prove to Bezdin, if it hits a situation where the lender has no doubt that there really was a loss, then in Chrami, many places can say that if he knows there is no loss, then that there is a loss, he cannot demand it. But if he doesn't know it, it's just your word. You come in with a spreadsheet that you printed off, your QuickBooks, at the end of the day, that depends on your trust or someone else in your office, and I can say, I never accepted that, and the deal was, if you wanted to make such a claim, you had to make sure there are witnesses watching what you were doing. Yes, because Moshe writes, if the investor is a partner and he knows firsthand what's happening and he knows there's a loss, then he cannot demand repayment. They have to split that loss 50-50. And therefore, an iska between partners runs into this problem. We'll talk a little bit later about how to deal with it in many cases. What? If you know for it as a fact, then you cannot ask for it back. A heter iska has a level of risk. It is a partnership. You have to understand it's a partnership. And if the recipient proves, or if you know there was a loss, if you demand the money back, that's not iska. That's not heter iska. That is called ribis. And it's something which every lender or every investor has to be prepared to accept. Excellent, excellent. The halacha is, and this is a problem, and there are many forms floating out there that are very misleading. When you do an iska, the pshat is not, I'm giving you the money, it's a partnership, but since you don't want to make a shavua, you agree, you're paying back the principal and interest, and everyone's happy. That's not what's happening. What's happening is it's a partnership. Any given day or any given month, you have the right to call up the lender and say, this is a partnership. Let's go to Beis Din. I have two witnesses. I'm ready to make a shavua, and you need to share in this loss. You always have that right. You have an option at any given, whenever a payment is due, instead of bringing that proof, you have the right to instead pay the principal and interest, and then not have to make the shvuah. But tomorrow, next month, when I send you another bill, there's another payment due, you still retain that right to come into Beis Din, prove what happened, and then the two parties will share in the loss. Now, there is a heteriska, a popular form which is floating around, which it uses language to the effect that, you know, it has a whole beautiful introduction about a chatzimilva, chatzipikada, and it's an investment, it's a partnership, it's not interest. But then it says, the blank has agreed that they shall accept, that the blank shall accept my payment of, and you fill in the interest rate, in lieu of the shvuah and the eidah. Now, if you read it very carefully, it doesn't say that the borrower has agreed to make this payment in lieu of the shvuah. If you read it very carefully, it just says the lender has agreed to accept the payment in lieu of the shvuah. But the borrower always keeps the right. If he, at any given time he says, I'm ready to make a shvuah, I'm ready to bring eidim, the halacha is they have to go to Beis Din and the lender will share in that loss. Now that particular form, it is somewhat misleading. Whenever someone comes to me with a form, I ask them, what would happen if you decide in 6 months from now to make a shvuah? Do you have the right to do it? And inevitably, everyone who reads the form assumes that it means they're waiving their right to make a shvuah, they're agreeing up front, in which case the heteriska is possible and would be ribbis. But, again, technically, if you read it carefully, it's not what it says, but it's kedai to use to make it clear and make sure both parties understand the borrower at all times can make a shvuah or bring eidim and default on the payments.
But at the moment that the decision is made,
it's a decision you made now. Yesterday, I have the right. Because your decision is only on the past. It is a partnership. What you're telling the investor is, instead of proving what happened and doing, I'd rather today just make this payment to you. Tomorrow, I'll have that same decision. I'll still retain the option to bring the okay, if I'm paying you back, because it's a partnership. Whenever there's a partnership, if we have a fight, we have a dispute, we have a litigation, and I decide, instead of going through the litigation, instead of bringing the witnesses, instead of making an oath, I'd rather just pay you off. It doesn't change into a loan. It was a partnership where you were exposed to risk. Where the other party, instead of making the shvuah and exercising his right to share in the loss, he'd prefer to pay you. That's a decision the borrower makes on a day-by-day or monthly basis. And it doesn't. And if he chooses to pay you off, that doesn't make it into ribs. Excuse me? He agreed right now. Right now there's a payment due, there's an interest payment due, so right now he has to give you the profits. He can make a shvuah what the profits are, or he can make this payment. In a month from now where there's a new profit payment due, he can make a shvuah. Over the past 30 days there's a loss. On this payment, he made a decision today, it's already due. You know, this ISK has been going on for a month. As a partner, you're entitled to a share. I can either make a shvuah and say there are no profits, you get zero. Or instead of making a shvuah, I'd rather give you your $1,000, I'm going to do that to buy out the shvuah. Regardless of what decision I make, it doesn't change the fact that it is a partnership that has a level of risk for the investor. Oh, we'll get to it. That will be a problem. We're going to get to that shortly. Well, the personal responsibility is only if he can't prove, if he doesn't make a shvuah and doesn't bring eidim. If he brings eidim, there's a loss, then the personal recourse goes off. But we'll get back. We'll talk about collateral either later today or next week. So, what? Right, correct. That we discussed last week. There was in Eretz Yisrael. There was the one story that I know of where someone successfully was able to prove a loss. Was when there was an Israeli bank lent money on a margin account, and therefore they knew there was a loss and there was a problem. Oh, if someone refused to pay based on this argument, the bank ended up, after a whole back and forth, ended up eating the loss. We'll talk to you later how they modified the heter iska for so that it shouldn't happen again. But you know, if you use a regular heter iska on a margin account, you will have this problem.
So
completely correct.
So if subsequently you make payments, the children on the first.
So that raises a question. If you make payments saying this is I'm giving you these are profits, and then later you change your mind, that's a whole discussion whether after you pay it you can go ahead and say I didn't really mean it. It wasn't really profits. That's a time of Nitzan Shaila. It's actually discussed over here in Kufayin Zayin. But we'll get to next week what's done to avoid that. So now that we understand the basics of a heter iska, some of the important halachas will fall into place. The first, as we've just explained, is there's a level of risk. The investor, the lender, has to understand there is a level of risk. If he thinks it is just a kameya, it's just an amulet, he thinks it's a loan, which somehow the rabbi blessed, you have a problem. He has to know it's a partnership. He has to know it's at risk. You can certainly tell him the risk is minimal. It's historically, it's, you know, it virtually never happens. But it's a risk that he has to be prepared to accept. Now, for the attorneys here, if you're representing the lender, you have my sympathies. Because the lenders usually want to, before they approve any documents, they want their attorney to sign off. Now, an attorney that's telling a lender, yes, sign the ISCO, it's not a problem, is really running a certain level of risk, because if the borrower this time decides to make a shavur, decides to bring Edim, so al pi halacha, he can't, you know, the lender will suffer a loss. So it's something which you have to be sensitive to. On one hand, you know, you want to reassure him, you want to encourage him to write the heter iska, because you don't want him to be over the yesaribis. And if you're his attorney, you don't want to be over the yesaribis, which drafting a shtar of ribis is a problem itself for the cipher. But on the other hand, he has to understand there is a certain level of risk and a certain chance that he has to take if he wants to do business with from people.
If the court won't recognize the element of risk in the iska, is there an element of risk?
Excellent. So if you're dealing with two from, we'll talk about it more about rechus later, but if you're dealing with from people, what the courts will do is not relevant. Because they have a cheses kasher, so you can assume they go to Besdin. As far as your malpractice insurance, I would suggest, and don't take my word for it, and certainly don't sue me if I'm wrong, that even if you recommend someone write a heter iska, legally, it seems the courts are fairly hostile. They will ignore the heter iska. Now, it's true, al pi halacha, the person has a chiyuv to go to Besdin, in which case he'll end up suffering a loss. But I doubt you can sue a lawyer for malpractice for telling you to sign a document that the courts won't enforce. Because who asked you to go to Besdin afterwards? So, again, for what it's worth, I don't think you could be sued, but obviously. There certainly is. People do not like making shavuos, but they do not like administering shavuos, but it certainly is a risk. Now, I have never seen an ISCO where the borrower was able to pater himself on the keren by bringing edim. I have seen cases where he's gotten out of some or all of the profits. Because if he's ready to make a shavuah, if he makes a shavuah, if he's able to bring in such compelling evidence where the other person really knows, that's done. There is certainly more of a risk on the upside. What? You can't require edim on the profits. If you want to claim a claim of loss. If the person says, I'm ready to give you back the principal, but there are no profits, there you cannot require anything more than a shavuah. So that's why there certainly is a higher risk on that, and something which, again, a lender, if you're doing an ISCA, this risk has to be there. If you eliminate the risk, call it what you want, but it's a loan, and you're back to ribis. It is very questionable whether it works. You have to, now, they do not necessarily have to know all of the chatzim over chatzim because of the lomdus, but the basic understanding that it's a partnership, and under certain circumstances, the borrower, the recipient, will not have to pay it back because it's a partnership which entails risk, is something that they have to know. If they don't, it is there's actually two from the Igros Moshe, one where he says it's fine, the other one says it's not. I don't know which one of the two isn't dated, so it's hard to know which one's written first. But it's I don't think so. One of them was from Luban, where I think that's the one where he says that it's mutter. One that he says that it's aser was I don't know where it's gone. But it's not clear. It is a big shayla. If they don't know bichlal, they think it's a loan, then it's certainly aser. Once they know if it's a partnership and a risk, I don't know how much detail they have to know. But raya, most people who go into partnerships don't read all the legal documents either. So you can't be. They just have to know conceptually it's a partnership with a certain level of risk. So heteroskel klali we'll get to with the bank. Banks are treated a bit differently. The heteroskel klali is something which either next year or this year afterwards, it is a separate issue. But in general, I spend a good chunk of my waking hours when people are talking about heteroskel. I will not just email someone a form. I will insist on giving them a very brief overview of what a heteroskel is and some of the risks involved. And I usually do it to both parties. Because... Very rarely. So it's actually interesting. If the malva is from, and it's a question of the borrower, if you think about it, a borrower can never lose out because of a heter iska. Because a loan has to be paid back no matter what. An iska simply gives him there are certain contingencies where he doesn't have to pay back. So it is the borrower will never lose out. So if the borrower is not from, doesn't understand it, gets nervous, his lawyer starts having annoying, you can write in the heter iska that this document cannot, you know, will not in any way impair the rights of the borrower, and then the borrowers are usually fine with it. If the lender is not from, it is much more problematic, because at the end of the day, he has to be willing to accept a certain level of risk, and it's something which he won't understand, he doesn't know what bezdin it is, he doesn't really... You know, he doesn't have that much confidence in it. In general, if the lender is from the tri-state area, his lawyer probably is familiar with the concept and more often than not will push it through. But if he's at it down, he never heard of it, it can be a problem if the lender is not from. Now, you do have to be careful. You know, one of the first times where I dealt with a not from borrower and I told the lawyer he can add this clause that the ISCA cannot be used against the borrower. So he was very happy. His lawyer was okay with it. He said he'd write it up. So I, as I typically do, I ask them, before you sign the documents, I want to see the final version of all of the loan documents. So I get it back, and it says that this ISCA cannot impair the rights of the borrower or the lender. So again, nice Italian lawyer, you can't expect too much. I called him up, and I said, he said, Rabbi, it's not fair. If it can't hurt the borrower, then we have to make it fair. It can't hurt the lender either. Now, obviously, if you do that, you completely kill the entire ISCA, but it's an issue. It's an issue. Very often, lawyers like putting into the documents that it's not enforceable in court. And okay, well.
Is there, I mean, it looks like burden of credit. If a person makes a shul,
that's true. If you invest money with someone, forget about an ISCA. If someone has this great investment for you, and you call them back a few weeks later and say you invested it with Madoff, it's all gone. People won't invest with you again. Now, there will be times where, we forget about ISCA, where a real investment, where you make a calculation, it is more kedai for me to give the person back his money than to get a reputation as being a miserable person to invest with. You can make such calculations.
Isn't that how the whole system works?
It is understood, and it's in the Chasam Sofer and in the Achroinim, it seems pretty clear that the understanding was they would not take advantage of it. But the same way, if there's a true partnership, and I happen to know, at the end of the day, even if it goes sour, it's going to be kedai for you, for your relationship, for your reputation, to take money out of your pocket. But if you have no obligation to do it, it's a partnership where I'll be din, and you have every right to default. So what you will choose to do afterwards, or what I expect you to choose, doesn't change the halacha. So over here, although we know with an iska, the expectation is it will be paid, you will not make a shavuah. You have the right to do it. If you decide at that point when the ISCA is due, your reputation isn't worth quite that much, you have a right to make the shavuah, to bring the edus, and that's why al pi halacha it's mutter. So this is the first basic halacha, which is, you know, I can't stress too much, and that is you have to know there's a certain level of risk. The second important halacha is, and this should be obvious from the discussion, is that the entire basis of an ISCA is you're giving the money. There's going to be a partnership. There's an investment. On the other hand, if you're giving the money, the person is not investing it. He's using it to pay bills, go on a cruise around the world, something which does not generate profits. The concept of an ISCA makes absolutely no sense. What profits? What partnership? What shutvas? I'm giving the money. I'm writing the check right out to your grocery. How can I come back to you later and say, I want a share of the profits? What profits? You paid for my milk and cheese. So the halacha is, an iska can only be done if the person is actually investing the money. Now, very often you'll have a person who has investments, but he needs cash for something else. He needs to pay grocery bills. Here there's an iska, and that is, let's say I have some real estate, and I want to sell you, I want to take you in as a partner. I can tell you, I'm going to sell you a share of this building that I have, whatever the price is. But instead of giving the money to me directly, or instead of writing out to the LLC, you cut a check to my creditor, to my grocery, to my credit card, and in exchange for that payment, I'm going to give you a share in my property. That's perfectly okay. So if the person is using the money for, if these dollars are going to pay bills or for something which doesn't, that's still fine as long as the recipient has other investments. You just write the iska in a way where in exchange for the money that's being advanced to the credit card, whatever it's going, he's selling him a share in his other assets. That's, as long as you draft the iska correctly, that's perfectly fine. The problem is that what happens if you're lending the money to a younger man in yeshiva? He has no investments. He's not using, this is going for personal expenses. So where is the iska? Where is the shutvas? Now in a practical sense, if he has no investments and no income, you're not going to get your money back. But putting that aside, the idea of writing a heter iska, if it's not being invested, or the borrower does not have other investments to assign to you in exchange for this money, does not make sense. And according to Rav Paiskim, you cannot write a heter iska if the person is not investing it. Now, the lender doesn't always know that. Someone comes to borrow money, the lender doesn't have, if he comes back a few years, when it comes time to repay, and says, listen, I used the money to pay bills, I didn't have any investments, he can say, prove it. It's the same requirements of a shvur or edus would still apply. But if you know it's not being used for investment and he doesn't have investments, you have a problem. Now, there, You could to the extent that he comes later and says, I never invested it, you can tell him, prove it, make a shvuah. But if you know in advance, so there is no partnership that you can demand a shvuah on what? A shvuah that your gross, that your milk didn't earn a return? The partnership doesn't begin. Now there is a shayla umeshiv that has a chiddush. He says that had you not taken this money, you would have had to quit your job or something because you would have had to get money elsewhere, or you would have had to sell things at a loss. He has a chiddush that itself is called an iska. The Marsham goes back and forth with it. If a person is faced with a situation, he should ask a sheilas chacham. There are heterim, but me'ikar hadin, I think the pashtus is either this money has to be invested or you have to have the equivalent amount invested elsewhere. The house itself today, the place can say, is an investment because, first of all, capital gains. Second of all, to the extent that the house belongs to the investor, he has the right to charge you rent. So although you're not paying yourself rent, but it is generating value, it is generating the fact that it can be lived in, and therefore the agreement could be is that you pay the investor half of the value of that rent. So that's perfectly fine. It's actually something that I put into the ISCA is that, you know, any profits, capital gains, or the use of real estate.
And for that matter, if a person owns a car or any other larger
plan. Cars, with all due respect, are a lousy investment because they go down in value. So by definition, it's a loss.
What?
The longer the iska goes on, the more you'll lose.
But it happens to be in the last 3 years, it's not true.
Okay.
So
on the other hand, if you know his only asset is a Camry. What? If you know, if you know he has a specific asset, even a house is nothing wrong with writing ahead to risk him. But if you know this is his only asset, and you know what's going on in the real estate market, you're going to have a problem again. Because then you have first-hand knowledge there was a loss or there were no profits, depending on the situation. Because, you know, that's not something which you can tell them, I want you to prove real estate in Lakewood went down over the past 5 years. That's something which is probably an established fact or whatever, again, depending on the situation. So you won't. When you're giving money and he's investing in his personal business, you have no idea what happened. you're perfectly legitimate to say Edim Shvua or Pei. But if it's something like this house, and this house is something which is well defined in front of us, and the Malva, the Leiva, Bezdin, and everyone else knows what the value is, then you might run into a problem. So the Shaul Meshev says such a svara that you can use grumas, the fact that had I not given it to you, the difficulty with it is it's hard for that to really be called a partnership. It's true, if you don't get up, you won't be able, you know, if you don't have shoes, you can't go to work. But does that mean that someone who buys shoes is now a partner in your entire, in your job? It's a chiddush.
Can you just kind of run it, like, tell about it? Look, I'm giving you to invest this, you know?
So if you know it's not invested and you know he doesn't have investments, then it's ribbis. If you give it to him expecting him to invest, he claims later he didn't, he has to prove it. Edim Shvua, whatever the proof will be. But if you know and it's understood he will not be invested, calling it an iska doesn't really change anything. If a dollar, so that's really the next question. What kind of rate of return can you demand on an iska? Now, if you think about it, before we get to the heter part, what's an iska? It's a partnership where we split the profits and losses 50-50. You have to make a shvua what the profits were. So we give you an out. Instead of making the shvua, you can make this payment. So the poskim all say this payment has to be a reasonable amount that a person would accept instead of half of the profits. So if you're investing it, you know the person is investing, he's buying treasuries with it, and he's earning 1%. You can't give him an iska where he's paying 10%. Because it doesn't make sense to pay 10% for half of the profits of treasuries. So whenever you're doing a standard iska, chatzim of a chatzim b'kadoin, wherever it's being invested, assuming you know what it's being invested for, the rate that you're asking for cannot be more than half of what he's expecting to earn. Now, depending on the industry, if someone's flipping real estate, you can earn a very high return very quickly. So depending on the industry, depending on what it's being used for, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean it has to be the prime rate. But if you're asking for more than half of his expected rate of return, there the iska doesn't make sense, and that would be a problem. So if you're going to take the iska, only invest a dollar, you can demand as payment whatever profits that dollar can reasonably be expected to make, which is not going to be very much. Now this issue is something which very, you know, if you have people who are desperate for money, especially with short-term loans, will pay a very high rate. They'll pay a few points immediately. If you don't expect the person, or it's not plausible for the person to be making that kind of money in this short period of time, then you have a problem. The iska has to be based on what return the person could be earning. You don't necessarily. So it depends. If he's doing it, if he's flipping real estate, then overnight he can be making a very high return. On the other hand, if you know what he does for a living and he's, you know, and it's not the rate that you're demanding, you're a loan shark, and the rate that you're demanding doesn't make sense for what he's doing. He's just doing it because he's desperate. That would be awesome.
Do you have to know him?
You don't have to ask questions. But I'll give you an example where this happens all the time. When you have a hard money lender where someone's flipping real estate and he has to borrow money to put down a deposit. Now the deposit is sitting in escrow, it's never leaving. That being said, if the deal goes through, they're going to make a very high return in a very short period of time because they're not closing. They're just flipping it right away. So on one hand, in such a case, you can write an iska and you can be earning a very high return because if it goes through, even though it's a short-term loan, you know exactly what it went for. This is a deposit. They double their money. They triple their money in a month. So good. So you're entitled to, you can ask for a very high rate on the iska. But once you're doing that, once you're saying, I'm entitled to a 20% return in a month because this is the deal that it's going for. So what happens if the deal doesn't close? It was put in escrow and it came right back to you. So you can't demand Edim Shvua. You know it didn't close. Your money came right back to you. There was never a closing. So if you give him money and you tell him, forget about this deal. I want to be partners across all of your assets, everything. So then, the rate of return you can ask for a month is an optimistic amount that someone can earn throughout all of his assets. If you want a higher return, because you want to be a partner in this deal, then you have to take the risk as well. And if this deal doesn't go through, then you can't ask for any profit because you have firsthand knowledge that there were no revachim. Okay, there were a lot of loose ends. People asked questions, which I deflected till later in the shiur. We're out of time. But Amir Hashem, over the next 2 weeks, we should be able to get to all of the practical issues that people raised.